What I'm going to do before I show some pictures, slides of our work and what we do, I wanted to backtrack a little bit. This morning, I told you back in 1994 how Patty and I became Christians in 94, at the same time these people over in Nigeria started praying for us, that God would send them a doctor. And so what I want to do is just give you a short little testimony so you know kind of how we got to that point. And so I also want to encourage you at any point to please ask questions while we're doing the slides or whatever, and we can get you involved. And don't worry, I'll get the beauty and the brains of the operation involved over here. She'll interject things every once in a while. But in 1994, we were moving to Temple, Texas, for me to finish medical school. We had never really been to church, had never taken, at the time, Elise, our oldest daughter, who's 13, was five, I guess, at the time. And she heard us talking about the fact we would need to put her, start looking for a school for her to attend. She heard Patty and I discussing this, and she said, "Well, I don't want to go to a school unless they teach about Jesus." And we don't know where that came from. That was from the Holy Spirit. So my attitude was, well, fine, that means a private education, so sure, you know, we can send her to that school. And so when we moved to Temple, we found a little school, and Patty's motive, I think, I don't want to speak for her, but her motive for going to church was school was going to start in a few weeks, and she wanted Elise to be comfortable in the church building. So she decided to start taking Elise to church on Sunday morning just so she would feel comfortable in the building. And she immediately heard...
You're going to be talking for me.
Right. So, and I'll let you tell her what she heard. Or let her tell you. Go ahead.
So anyway, I guess I heard the gospel for the first time. And I didn't even know what was happening. But all I knew was after that first Sunday that I couldn't wait for the next Sunday. And the praise music would go through my head all week. And you know, I didn't know anything about what was happening. We didn't even own a Bible. But I knew that I was rapidly moving away from him. And so I kept asking him to come with me. Well, before that, our Sunday mornings were either working or studying or reading the paper and having a nice breakfast. And so he was planning on continuing that, and he said, "I'll leave you alone if you leave me alone." So I continued to go, and I guess it was a few months later, a friend of mine said, "You need to get your husband to go to a Promise Keepers conference," because she'd realized that he wasn't coming along. You want to tell?
She tricked me into going to this this Promise Keepers conference. She, when she told me about Promise Keepers, it sounded like something, why would I want to be involved with this? Well, she said, Mike Weddington's going to go. For a few of y'all, it may ring a bell. Mike actually played for Oklahoma. He played for the Green Bay Packers after that. Patty knows I love football, so she said, "Well, Mike Weddington's going to this Promise Keepers conference. You can ride along with him, and y'all can talk about football all weekend." So
and
I thought,
and
it was in Texas Stadium where the Cowboys play and all that. So I thought that sounded like a pretty good deal for me. So I went. It's a long story, but I went. And the first night, I was sitting in the very opposite end zone from where the stand was set up, and they were giving a basic gospel message for people like me. And he said that there was going to be an altar call after he was finished with his message. And he had mentioned that a couple times. And I had no idea what that was. I didn't grow up exposed to any of that. I thought you came forward and they hit you in the head and you fell and they took your money. I didn't know. But so I didn't. I just knew it didn't apply to me. So, but I continued to listen. And he shared the gospel. It was the first time I heard a consistent message kind of from start to finish. And when he gave that altar call, thousands of men, I guess, were streaming out of this stadium and out of the stands coming forward. And I remember it was as if somebody picked me up by the collar, by the back of my shirt, and I found myself standing up And I remember even thinking, what am I doing? And I'm passing by these guys, and I go down forward, had to walk the entire length of that football field, and knelt down there with hundreds of other men crying and accepted Christ. And it truly was like the scales fell from my eyes. My life changed. I mean, I can't even describe to you. People that knew me before wouldn't know me now. When I walked in the door that Sunday evening at the end of that weekend, I didn't even have to tell Patty what happened. When I walked in the door, she looked at me and she knew, because I looked different physically. It was that dramatic of a change. So I went out the next day, that Monday, and bought myself a Bible, bought Patty a Bible, and we just started studying and trying to learn. We knew absolutely nothing.
You know, we were saying, why did Jesus have to die on the cross? Why couldn't God just have taken away sin? And so we're sitting there across from each other with our Bibles going, okay, where do we even find this? So we looked up Jesus. Too many references there. But we just, night after night, would sit with our Bibles, and the Holy Spirit led us and taught us.
Well, and as I said in Sunday school, Patty's always a few steps ahead of me. So she had already, she started thinking about missions before I did. Do you want to share about that?
I was so grateful for my salvation, and I just thought, you know, why would God call two doctors in their 30s unless it's so that we can go and bring Him glory with the gifts that He's given us? And but Tracy still had, you know, he had had a vision for his family, and now that Christ was in him, he kind of had a new vision, but he still had his plan. And he was going to join a practice with a group of Christian physicians, and we were going to go settle on a ranch, and he was going to practice medicine and have cows. He really, really liked cows, and he wasn't ready to give that vision up. And he said, maybe we could do some short-term trips, but that's about it. And then one night, he had been at a BSF study, and he came in that night, and he said, I realize God has given me everything that I could ever have wanted, and I'm going to give it back to Him. And I knew that that was it. I knew that God had done the work that we had desired, that I had desired. And from that point on, doors just flew open. Within 6 weeks, I think, we were at mission headquarters. And within about a year, I guess, we were on our way.
Now, we went to a medical meeting in Brunswick, Georgia. At that time, we knew we were going to missions. We knew God had put Africa in our hearts. We knew we were going to Africa, but we didn't know where. And on the way to this meeting, I told Patty that, okay, you know, we're going. Africa's a big place, though. I said, but I don't want to go to West Africa, and especially not Nigeria. I literally told her that. And within 12 hours, maybe, of her saying that, they had her... They had her sitting next to a doctor from Nigeria that somebody had sponsored to come over for this meeting. And he told us about the needs in Egbe, in Nigeria, and immediately we both knew that that's where God wanted us. We came home from that meeting. I went to an SIM prayer meeting in Dallas, where I met a doctor who had just returned from Egbe. Egbe's not even on the map. This man had pictures of Egbe. He had pictures of the house we would live in, the people, the chapel there, and he gave me a book called Tread Upon the Lion about Tommy Titcomb, the first SIM missionary into that area. Months before, when missions started to become a part of our lives, God had given Patty Jeremiah 33:3. Call to me and I will answer you and tell you great and unsearchable things you do not know. She even had it up on the refrigerator and all that. And she said, I don't know why, but this is a significant verse for our family. Well, I get home from this meeting from Dallas, and I said, Patty, you're not going to believe this. I said, you know, the Nigerian guy told us about Egbe. We think that's where God wants us to go. I said, I've got pictures of this place. And she couldn't believe it. So we're looking through the pictures, and I said, oh, yeah, and he gave me this book, too, that's about Egbe. So we're looking through the pictures, and Patty picks up the book and opens it up, and in the back there's a chronology. She opens it up, and the first thing she reads is January 1, 1908. Tommy enters Yagba land, which is where Egbe is, and claims Jeremiah 33:3 for his work with the Yoruba people. And we just couldn't, I mean, it's incredible. I don't know if it's because we were such new believers or what, that God just needed to knock us over the heads and make things obvious, but He did. And so anyway, that's kind of how we got to the point of heading to Egbe. And so what I want to do is we're going to probably run through some slides and show you just a little bit about the work. Now, a lot of people don't know, there's Nigeria. I have to be careful. I insulted someone one time by saying it's in the armpit of Africa, literally and figuratively. And it is. It's a tough place to live. Ask Randy if you ever want to know. But there's Nigeria. It's the most populous black nation in the world, 120 million people. This is a close-up. Now, the capital here is Abuja. We live about where this M is on Abomasaw. So there's nothing else around in here. So we're right here. Our oldest daughter, Elise, lives and goes to school in Jos, and this is where we met Randy. And this is about an 8 to 10 hour drive from here to here. This is about the size of Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, I think. So it's a big place, but there's a lot of people there. When we first got to Nigeria, we spent the first 6 months in Jos. We needed to learn how to live. There's a lot of missionaries in Jos. They could teach us how to get food, cook there, and do these types of things. So while we were there, this ministry it's called Blind Town Ministry, opened up. Blind Town is like a huge slum within the big cities of Nigeria. And it's literally where all the blind, the cripple, and the lepers live. They all congregate in this one huge kind of city within a city, all Muslim. Well, they needed a way to get in to offer something to these people. So the people that started this ministry wanted to have a medical outreach into Blind Town. So every Tuesday, I think it was, we would go off into Blind Town and treat these people. The lepers in particular were very resistant for us to come into their area because we were Christian. And then Randy and Anna joined us here, so I'm sure some of these scenes are familiar to you. Randy may even be in a picture, I don't know. But you can see this is just like a huge sewage going through this, just to give you an idea of the type of slum. These mud houses are just packed together for miles, and this is how these people live. Well, one of the first five or so trips in there, Patty found a man with leprosy. He had had the sores for so long they had become cancerous. And the stench was so bad, the other people couldn't even be around him. Well, Patty convinced him to let us take him back to the hospital. And I had to amputate his leg. And it saved his life. And it changed his life. He was so thankful. He was so grateful. But more importantly, the people, when we returned to Blind Town with him a couple of weeks later, they gave us a celebration. This is one of the blind men dancing. They had these chains around their ankles dancing, making all this music, and they gave us this big welcoming when we brought him back into Blind Town. They were so thankful for what we had done for him. And we took him into his hut, and the leper chief and their elders came with us, and our interpreter really couldn't believe what he was hearing. They were talking about, these men were crying, and they started talking about seeing now that true healing could only come through Jesus Christ. And they recognized Jesus as a prophet. And they have two different words they use for Jesus as a prophet and Jesus the Messiah. And they kept referring to Jesus the Messiah. And subsequently, there's Patty with the blind chief. The blind chief became a Christian from this outreach. The leper chief became a Christian from this outreach. And now this ministry has moved up into northern Nigeria, into the Sharia law states where they have the strict Muslim law. And I got an email from Peter Fredheim, who runs that ministry, about a month ago, that they had 60 to 80 more Muslims in these strictly Muslim towns come to Christ through this work that's continued through the Blind Town ministry. I thought you'd be interested in that since you were part of that. It's amazing what Peter's continued to be able to do. So after we spent 6 months there in Jos and helped that get started, the medical part, we headed to Egbe. This is downtown Egbe. Not a whole lot there. this is our king, the Elegbe. That's their word. So he is the Elegbe of Egbe. They gave us, yeah, it's got that nice little ring to it. They don't see any humor in that. I almost laugh every time I say it, but they gave us a huge welcoming. It had been since 94 when their last missionary left. They knew the value of missionaries, and they saw the decline of the hospital and what had happened when they left. So they were very thankful that we came. They gave us a great reception there. Now, these are the Yoruba people. Nigeria has three main tribes. In the north is Hausa, all Muslim. In the southwest is Yoruba. Southeast is Igbo. And then they have about 400 other, literally 400 other tribes scattered around. The Yoruba people are in our area are subsistence farmers. Very poor people. You can see these children, the big bellies, that's from malaria. They've had malaria so many times, that's their spleen that takes up most of their abdomen. But people that live hand to mouth, and they subsist on yams. And a yam is just like a huge root, a huge white root. They chop up, they boil, and then they have to pound it like this for 30 or 45 minutes into the consistency of Play-Doh, and they make a soup out of bitter leaf, baobab tree leaves, whatever, different types of soup, and that's what they subsist on. So malnutrition is a problem there. This is Walmart, where actually there's a market every 9 days, I think it is, or seven, and Patty can go there and shop, but she can just get raw material, sacks of things. Can't get any type of Western food at all. We have to usually go to Joss for something like that. Egbe is hot or very hot. We have 6 months of dry season and 6 months of rainy season. There's no telephones, there's no TV. Electricity, we usually have to depend on a generator. And what you see here is the harmattan. This back here is sand from the Sahara Desert. When the winds come out of the north at the beginning of dry season, I think it is, it brings this sand from the north, and visibility sometimes is dangerous to drive. And so it's not an easy place to live. But you can see we have a very nice house. This is our home. It was a cinder block house. We painted it, added a porch, fixed it up, and we've been very blessed to be able to have a home like this there. This is the view behind our house to give you an idea. We're in an area that it's right at the border between tropical rainforest and open savanna. So we're surrounded by a chain of about seven mountains, and standing on the one behind our house, if you look out, you get an idea. This is what the terrain's like around us. There's just nothing else out there. And our children suffer with their solid mahogany treehouse. Mahogany's the cheapest, most abundant wood, so that's what we used. But we have planted a farm around here, and I have this slide just to show you. We built this chicken coop and a cow pen back here because most people can't pay for their medical care. So they'll bring us chickens as pay or as a way of saying thank you. And so we ended up, I think, got up to about 40 chickens. But it was neat because we were able then to get the children involved in the ministry. There's Sam catching a rooster. And Jimmy in particular would collect the eggs, boil them, and take them down to the hospital. Because we have children that literally the parents have to decide that day, am I going to buy food for my child or am I going to buy the medicine that the doctor says the child needs to take? They can't do both. So the children were able to use eggs, some of the chickens, to take down to the malnourished children. And we were able to use, we have the farm, and we can use the maize and the yams and the peanuts from the farm to be able to help feed people at the hospital. And I keep meaning to take that out. It looks like I have horns here. But like Patty said, I like my cows. But that was kind of a neat thing. When I left, when I knew I was going to the mission field, in my mind, two things I gave up was my truck and cows. And we got there, and God gave me a four-wheel drive truck and cows. And so, anyway. So there's Elise. She's the only one you wouldn't have met yet. And what we did, we built, it's kind of like Beverly Hillbillies. We have the cement pond here. We actually built out of concrete. It holds water. It gets so hot during February, March, April, that even the Nigerians don't move around much. It's just too hot. So the kids can soak in the water there. And here's Katie, our blue-eyed Nigerian, and our night guard, Femi. He was appointed by the king when we got there, and he really makes it possible for us to be there. And, you know, I want to share some stories, and Patty, you can help me, that just seeing this reminds me that, you know, things are not always just this glorious, victorious, rosy picture in the mission field. It's tough. It's very tough. We've had tough times. Right now, the reason I'm still standing here is because I was so burned out when we got back that SIM wanted us to stay longer in order to get some more rest. We were due to go back this month. Femi had, I've had curses put on me. Femi has dug up idols that were planted around our house for bad purposes. The Yoruba are supposed to be Christian, but they still have idol worship, and they still have these ceremonies and all this type of thing. And sometimes there's an oppression there that is just amazing. I mean, it's almost can be like clinical depression. You just feel it. And when we leave Egg Bay and we get a certain distance away, we can almost feel it lift. Sometimes, I mean, it's palpable. It's hard to describe. And so, again, if you have any questions concerning anything like that, I'll be glad to answer them. But Femi has made it possible for us to be there. He does find these idols and gets rid of them, and he's been a tremendous help and blessing for us. They were so excited when Katie was born. That this is the Alegbe. They gave her a naming ceremony. He had told me there had been no mission babies born while at Egbe. And so they gave this big naming ceremony and gave her, well, they gave her about four names, but the main one is Ayolua. And that's Yoruba for joy of the Lord. So they call her Ayo for short. And she was actually responding to that at the time we left. But so this is the king during her naming ceremony. And from that same mountain where you got a view of our behind our house, this is the hospital compound. Our house is right here in this clump of trees. Now, in the cities, compounds are, you know, walled off, and they've got the wire twisted around and broken glass and all that to protect you. But we're so far out, we're just on an open compound. But this has the hospital, there's a school of nursing, a school of midwifery, and a chapel. And then a school back over here for the Nigerian kids, called Titcomb College. At one time, SIM had 60 missionaries in Egbe. The hospital was built in 1953 by George Campion, and it fell into disrepair when the missionaries left. When we got there, we heard that they were about 2 weeks from finally shutting the hospital down, that it had gotten in such bad shape without any missionaries there. We have these open bed wards, and anywhere from 60 to 80 bed capacity. Sometimes the hospital is full. We have people actually on the floor. Other times there may be five people in the hospital. You just never know. It depends on whether it's harvest season or planting season. And in our outpatient department, we see 40 to 60 patients a day. And you know, we see the typical things we see here, high blood pressure, diabetes, but you also see just a myriad of tropical diseases, malaria. You still see leprosy, a lot of TB. You never know what's going to walk in the door. This is a huge thyroid. These people have had no health care, so things just go untreated there. That was a small bump, could have been easily treated, became a cancer. I won't linger on any of the medical stuff. This is a huge jaw tumor. It's been growing for 30 years on this woman. When I first saw this, the lighting was bad. I thought it was a skin graft that had gone bad. It's actually a tobacco leaf. This lady was self-treating, and that's what she was treating. It's a chronic ulcer. Tropical ulcer is a big problem. It can be treated, but if you don't treat it and let it go as they do for 30 years, it becomes this. It's called a Marjolin's tumor. It's a squamous cell carcinoma. It's a cancer. It becomes cancerous, and these legs have to be amputated. This is a result of Kaposi sarcoma. Some of you may have heard of that because it's associated with HIV. I knew people would ask, so right before we left, I went back and checked the last 100 HIV tests we did in the hospital. 33 were positive, and that's everybody for blood transfusions or whatever. So AIDS is a tremendous problem there. Also blindness. You see the little boy guiding the old man with the stick. So we're going to start doing cataracts at Egg Bay when we get back to help remedy some of those problems. Patty spends, well, I can't say most of her time. Patty does everything besides run the household and cook and homeschool. She practiced pediatrics. When she's at the hospital, she's in our pediatric clinic. And on vaccination day, they all dress up and dress their kids up in their best clothes and come in to get their vaccines. And malnutrition is a problem that overlies everything else Patty sees in these children. It's amazing. These children die from things that they shouldn't die from, mostly from the malnutrition. Malaria is a huge problem. There's times of year, well, here, just like you know, there's certain times of year all the kids in daycare are going to have a cold. There are times there all the children you know are going to have malaria, but a lot of them don't survive it. We also see some amazing tumors. This is a Burkitt's lymphoma, which you see along in the equator. Now, incredibly, Patty can treat this. The same thing here. That's a huge tumor. We had a 12-year-old come in. The tumor had involved the spine. He was already paraplegic, couldn't walk. And I guess, what was it, 5 days after Patty started the chemotherapy, the boy was up walking around. So these things can actually be cured. We can go into the bigger cities, actually on the open market, and find chemotherapy. It's kind of amazing. But we're able to find it, and she can treat these kids. We've made our little kind of homemade pediatric ICU, or I guess neonatal ICU. And for some reason, no one knows why, but where we are has the highest twinning rate in the world. There are more twins born to women there than anywhere else in the world. Subsequently, we see a lot of small birth weight babies and premature babies. So the incubator quit working about 30 years ago, so we use lamps and hot water bottles to keep the babies warm, and Patty gets by using that. If I'm not out in the bush, I spend all my time in the OR. I guess I'm a self-trained surgeon, you can see we have a state-of-the-art OR for about 1960, I guess. But we get by. I'm the one in the Dallas Cowboys hat, by the way. And I have a Nigerian, young Nigerian doctor that acts sort of as a resident that I train. I feel guilty. I go and read the book and come out and act like I know what I'm doing and teach him. But I include this picture because the lighting is bad in the OR, and because I should have known I was over my head. The first night we got to Egg Bay, I was called down to the hospital. There was a woman that was 28 weeks pregnant, and she had a bowel obstruction. And surgery is the last thing you would think about doing on a pregnant woman, really, for anything other than a C-section, I guess. And it became obvious over the hours that this woman was in a lot of trouble. And we did have to take her to surgery. And I had never even done a colostomy. And I had to do a colostomy. We did find a tumor. There was a tumor blocking her intestine. So I had to do this colostomy around this pregnant uterus, and in the middle of it, our lights went out. And it's just a typical thing. I mean, that just happens. And so we finished the case with somebody holding a flashlight over the OR. It's amazing the things. I mean, I'll be doing surgery and see spiders come down from the scene. Right into the... And I've got a mask on and I'm blowing. And then I realize, you know, it's like, it's not going to do anything. So anyway, this... that's from a snake bite. That's his bone. I won't linger on that. That's a typical problem. He had been bitten 3 weeks before. The problem we have is people will still go to witch doctors and local healers. The little bit of money they have, they will spend on the witch doctor. Then when they're almost dead and have no money, they'll show up on the doorstep of our hospital. They know we won't turn anyone away. We don't. And unfortunately, obviously, that leg had to be amputated. Fortunately, he lived. Sometimes they don't when they wait so long and get so sick because of these witch doctors. This was just another boy, the amputation. Most of the children work. There are no laws in the workplace protecting anyone, even the kids. He was on a logging truck, and the logs rolled, crushed his leg. Oh, this is that big thyroid I showed you, the lady with the big thyroid. That's what came out of her, but that's afterwards. And so that would these women that have this are really stigmatized. They're kind of shunned by society. So it's a good thing when we're able to do these for them. So as I said this morning, we had an unexpected ministry start when we got to Nigeria. Had never heard of the Fulani people. And then Jebel showed up. This is Jebel. And God used this boy to start this entire ministry. He's the one that was bit by the snake, had the anaphylactic reaction, really almost died, should have died, medically speaking, and he was prayed through. And he survived it, and subsequently we were invited out to their camp. And that's just the cobra we see. That's the other one of the other dangers. We've had Femi, our night guard, has killed cobras, pit vipers, whatever, a lot of snakes in our yard. When the rainy season comes, the starts raining in the mountains, and the snakes come down out of the mountains. And so if sometimes just keep us in your prayers about that. I can worry about the kids sometimes. We've lost a couple of dogs and a cow even to snake bites. So it's a real problem there. There's Pastor Bob and Gita with the big smile on his face. He's always smiling. This is beautiful family. He's my closest friend there. He's an incredible man that has a heart for his people. And he's made our ministry possible. SIM really is excited about this. To them, they're excited about the way that we have teamed together, because it is truly what they want to do in missions. I couldn't be doing what I do without him, and he couldn't be doing what he's doing without me. It is truly a joint effort between the mission and the national church and pastor that makes this ministry work. And so that's exciting to see. So we did go out to Jebel's camp. This is, let me see if I can find a better picture. Patty's there out in the camps. You can see the grass set to get an idea of how the Fulani live. And that's Jebel. This is, I guess, about a week after he'd been bitten, and we're back out at the camp. You see the little children there in the background. And I have some better pictures of the women. I wanted to try to show some of the tattooing. When we went out to the bush to visit Jebel's camp and let them thank us, we were amazed at what we ended up doing, a clinic. There were all these sick people. They don't get any health care. The kids run around with these little leather straps and these amulets hanging with all, they put all types of whatever in there to ward off evil spirits and things like this. But most of the kids, I would say, were sick in some way or another. So we split up, and I took care of the men and the boys, and Patty was taking care of the girls and the women. And that's when I met this, we call him the Baba. This is Jebel's grandfather. They brought him out of his, they carried him out of his hut. He was dying of TB. They asked me to look at him to see if I could help him. It didn't take long to determine he had TB, and he'd been going downhill for a couple of years. I told him that I could probably help him, but he'd have to come back to the hospital with me for at least 3 or 4 weeks. And he said he'd come back and stay a year if he had to. He had heard about Jebel. So he came, and while he was there, we were able to share the gospel with him. And as I told you this morning, I found out this man is very powerful, and no one could stand up to him when he invited us back out to the bush to share the gospel. And a point that I wanted to make, and this is Patty's story, you may want to tell it. As I told you, the Fulani are the largest unreached nomadic people group in the world. They, less than 10% have ever even heard the name Jesus. And that was really brought home to me when the Baba came to the hospital and his wife came with him. It was funny, they packed up everything they had. It was like one little ball, about like this, on this little stick, and off they came to the hospital. And they, Bob and Gita was sharing with Jebel's grandmother, the Baba's wife, about, she asked him, why in the world would we come to Nigeria? Why would we? They have a concept of what America is. It's kind of like the promised land. And she asked why we would leave and go there. And he said, they are here because Jesus sent them and Jesus loves you. And she said, well, take me to go meet this man Jesus. I want to meet this man that loves me. She had literally never heard. And that struck me. That just brought it home to me that she had no idea. And that there are people in this information age that literally have not heard of Jesus Christ. We took the Baba back to the bush 3 weeks later, I guess. 3 weeks later, he was younger. He was out walking with his cows for the first time in years. All the other Fulani leaders around asked him, you know, what was going on? He said that he got medicine at the hospital with the power of Jesus. And I told you he quit going to the mosque, so they all accused me of giving him a shot to make him quit going to the mosque. And But he did. And, well, Dr. Jim Pluteman, SIM's international director, took this picture. He sent it to me because he said I look like a Fulani. So anyway, I usually include it. That's me and Jebel's grandfather. As I said, the Fulani are the largest unreached nomadic people group in the world. They follow their cows around. Cows are central to their lives. They have, you know, language is a reflection of culture. In their language, they have three words for colors. They have a word for white, a word for red, and a word for black. No word for blue or green or anything else. That's because that's the color of their cows. So that just gives you an example of how important cattle are to these people. And in retrospect, how God used my training in veterinary medicine, it's just amazing how He prepared us for this specific people, for this particular work. The Fulani live just as they have for the past hundreds of years. They have these grass huts. By the way, the women build these huts and actually do most of the work. And they live in very primitive conditions. Every time I try to get a picture of the old women doing some traditional type chore, they all run in and put on their best clothes and pose. I can't get a picture of them. So here they are posing. That's Jebel's grandmother actually right there. And this gives you an idea of the tattooing. These women get this done when they're about 10 years old. And the more tattooing, the better. It shows you're braver and then you're more valuable as a wife, the more tattooing you have. So they offered for Patty, I think, to get tattooed one time in the camp, but she declined. Well, Bob and Gita, because of Jebel's grandfather, he allowed it. We started going out in the bush in my truck. We would go out and usually break down somewhere along the way. But we would get out there and we could take medicine and hold little clinics out there. And we would find sick children everywhere we went. I would have cow medicine in one box, people medicine in another box. They would always make me look at the sick cows first, then I could look at the sick kids. But we would usually draw quite a crowd, and this particular time, every year there's a meningitis outbreak. After about two or three children have died, word will get back to us that there's a meningitis outbreak. We will take medicine out to treat the people that had been exposed. And this particular one became a circus. Everyone wanted to ride the fancy ride. No one had ever seen a scale before. So they actually started fighting over who was going to get to stand on the scale next and watch the numbers go around. And we had to get one of their elders to stand in line because the kids would get overdosed. They would get back in line if we weren't careful just to get more medicine, you know, to be able to stand on the scale. And this is our miracle girl. I won't go into the whole story again, but this is right before her discharge. This girl was, I've never seen anything like it. From her seizures, she had brain death to the point she was already posturing. And we prayed for her. Bob and Gita prayed for her in the name of Jesus. And this girl had a miraculous recovery. And you heard the story this morning. And it was because of that, word spread, that Bob and Gita and I started getting invited to these naming ceremonies and weddings. And this is at a Fulani naming ceremony. You see, very, very colorful, exciting people. This is, and as part of that, I got invited to the crowning ceremony I told you. It's actually a turbaning. They have this white turban. This is the new Fulani king. This is a Yorba king. It was in his land area, so we had to have his permission. So I got invited to this, and then this is where they had the soro. All the young women came, painted up. They got all dressed up, and I mean, there were literally hundreds of them, even the young men. And you see, there's those sticks. Now, I tell people I don't include the picture of me in Fulani drag. They actually put the makeup on me one time and all this perfume. I came home, it looked like I still had eyeliner on. Patty kind of looked at me like, anyway, this is where they had the soro. These guys got in the big circle. They took turns, had bare-chested. They were chanting. They had their arms up. These guys would dance around and swing. And you can see, I don't know, can you tell? Look at these welts. So this guy's standing there taking that beating. And this is when, this was taken shortly before that fight broke out. Bob and Gita and I made it to our truck. And this morning, as I said, this is where we found the man whose arm had almost been severed, bleeding to death, threw him in the truck. We were able to get him to the hospital. saved his life in his arm. And then this, I don't know who took this picture. This was 11 o'clock at night. I came out of there. There's Bob and Gita, always smiling. And that's when he introduced me to the boy's father, the new Fulani King. Again, God had chosen the perfect selected one to put in our path to open the door for the gospel for the Fulani people. So we went out to the new king's camp. This is where he told us, you can go anywhere. Well, he told me also at this point, we didn't know it, House of Muslim teachers, the strict Muslim people, had been following behind us when we would go in the bush to refute anything we say was said. And we didn't know that at the time. And Jebel's grandfather didn't know it either. The king knew it. So the king said, he told us that that was going on. He said he wasn't going to allow them to do it anymore. We could share our message openly. And if anyone wanted to become a Christian, they wouldn't be persecuted. And he himself became a Christian. They actually built me a hut in the king's camp. They wanted me to come out there and live with them. So we have a hut, so I don't have to set up a tent now when I go out and stay with them. And they really accepted us. There's Bob and Gita grinning again. They actually, the greatest honor they've given me, they gave me the name Pulut Butdejo. That's for full day. They have this implosive D and B, so it's Butdejo is the way. That means white Fulani. So they started calling me Pulut Butdejo and Bob and Gita, and we can be 8 hours drive away from Egbe and go into a Fulani camp, and they will have heard about our work. And they greet us with open arms. And they want to hear about... First thing they ask is about, want to see the Jesus film. And it's amazing. And they know about the work. And so they've really taken us in. I've learned to eat their food. This is Jebel's grandmother cooking me something. I don't ask anymore. I just eat it. And I don't want to know. A friend of mine, Bello, I guess paying me for some work we did on the cow. They couldn't stand the fact that we would work their cows for nothing. So, and it was with him that the whole cow working business got started. I'm kind of leaning over. Now, these cows are just running loose in the bush. Now, the calves are on a calf line. There's Jimmy helping me. But we would go out, and one weekend we vaccinated, was it two or three, Penny? 2,000 cows, something like that, in a weekend. And that weekend they used all my drinking water to mix up the vaccine. So they were bringing me river water to drink, and I asked them to boil it without thinking. They probably didn't know what that meant. And I ended up getting dysentery and meningitis. I was in bed for 2 months with IVs going, hanging from the curtains in the bedroom. And I mean, that had to be so tough on Patty. I mean, I don't know how she made it through that time. And what we want to do is now start a school, a boarding school that would basically be a Fulani camp with the huts, the cows. The children would come and learn. I mean, you saw their faces. They're so eager to learn. We're going to teach them to read and write English in full day by using the scripture. They will go back into their camps literate and hopefully believers. And no telling what God's going to do with that. It's just exciting to think about. So thank you, and I appreciate your prayers.